Good afternoon, everyone. Happy late afternoon on this Saturday, June 4th. How are you? I hope you are doing well. I see a lot of people already here in the chat early. So let me know how I sound. I hope I sound okay. I have about 90 minutes or just shy of 90 minutes to spend with all of you. The main topic today, I'm going to try to get to another subject by the end, but the main topic today is this anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, or the Tiananmen Square massacre that wasn't. So while you're coming in, be sure to like the stream, hit the notifications bell, subscribe to the channel and then hit the notifications bell, and be sure to, as we're entering the month of June, I was just shy of my goal for 10 more subscribers by the end of May. Please do support my work. The best way to do so is at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. You can find all the ways to support me in the description. It goes a long way. I'm still about just a little bit less than a couple hundred dollars per month away from my goal for 2022 to be able to make this work sustainable. So any assistance that you can provide in that, I am greatly appreciative, and I'm greatly appreciative for all of my loyal subscribers and for just anyone who supports this work, whether you can monetarily or you cannot, because I know so many of us are struggling under the onslaught of late-stage capitalism. So, hello, Death Leopards. Hello, Big Teal. You are here. Thanks for coming on. I know you got a Pride event coming. I hope you enjoy that. Good to see you, Isaac. Good to see you, Robert. And good to see you, Tijil? Good to see you, SCH Dow. Good to see all of you. Good suggestion, Penn. That's a really good suggestion. I will think about that and do what I am able. I actually did cover Tibet in a live stream a while back ago. I can't even say how long ago, a little less than a year ago, I would say. But it's good to be with all of you today on this Saturday afternoon. While you're coming in, of course, like this stream, subscribe to the channel, hit that notifications bell. And as I said before, the best way to support me is at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. That's how I make this work sustainable. So yeah, June 4th, 1989 is often known as the day, right? The day when China clamped down on pro-democracy protesters, on student protesters, massacring. I think the corporate media, New York Times, BBC, have all spread the propaganda that 10,000 plus people were killed on this day. You have the Tank Man propaganda, which we will get to our friend, the Tank Man, in this stream. But this is the narrative that has been pushed, that China is clamping down on democracy, that it was a dark day, and every single year we hear about it. It trends on Twitter. The Western media covers it as some kind of vigil moment that allows the West to have moral high ground over China. And I am going to demonstrate all of the various ways, or at least many of the various ways, because there's so many things that we could hit on, but many of the various ways in which this is nothing but propaganda, imperialist propaganda, pro-war propaganda. The Tiananmen Square massacre, we can confidently say, wasn't. It was not a massacre. Massacre did not occur on June 4th, 1989. And I'm going to just go over, I'm going to show you my thread. I'm going to go over the sources that I've used. I'm not going to read them all, you know, word for word, but I will go over one particular post that I reference a lot with regard to the Tiananmen Square massacre, or the incident that kind of puts together all of them and helps us chronologically at least look for them and reference them when we need to. And you'll be able to find that and many other sources in the description if you want to do further reading. I'm also going to go over something I literally just found, and that is the National Endowment for Democracy connection to the Tiananmen Square massacre. As I was looking through the influence that think tanks and NGOs like George Soros's reform and opening up organization that he founded in 1986, I also did find how the National Endowment for Democracy was involved in this, at least in the sense of a particular individual who was connected as one of the leaders of the riots or the so-called protests, and how he went on to found an organization that was literally started by the National Endowment for Democracy. So we got a lot to go over today. So while you're here, like that stream, hit that subscribe button, hit the notifications bell, and be sure to support my work at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. Let's get to this. So the Tiananmen Square massacre, right? The mainstream narrative goes 10,000 plus people were killed. China's government clamped down on pro-democracy protests that arose seemingly out of nowhere. And there was no justification for what they did. It was just a blatant example of how China is a dictatorship, an authoritarian government. And every single year that June 4th rolls around, the mainstream media, the Western media, and even the U.S. political class and a lot of its allies remember this day as a kind of a vigil moment. You know, you have the candlelight or whatever, and they all spread the propaganda that China committed what is a heinous, I've even been told that this is a genocide, right? A heinous crime against humanity. Now, what is the reality here? What actually happened on that day? Well, the reality is a lot more complicated, and I'm going to show you why. But I'm going to first just pull up a thread, and we'll review that very quickly. And then I'm going to pull up another source, which puts together a lot of different references, a lot of Western media that countered this narrative, but really wasn't paid attention to. One of the sources that we'll look at, or at least reference, is a WikiLeaks cable of a leaked document that demonstrated from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing that demonstrated there was no violence. And this wasn't even covered by any Western media except The Telegraph, which honestly is barely, it barely counts, right? So you had almost a media blackout over a WikiLeaks cable, which in my opinion is incredibly damning and demonstrates from a Chilean diplomat under the Pinochet regime basically stating that she saw no violence in Tiananmen Square during the protests, that protesters were able to go and come freely from the square. And I'm going to show you other documentation that seems to suggest that this exactly was the case, despite whatever the detractors and whatever the Western propagandists and their apologists want to say. So let me just pull up the Twitter thread really quick, because I think this gives a good summary and then of just what exactly I'm getting at. And then I'm going to get into the other source. So while you're waiting, please do like this stream, like, share it around. Please do subscribe to this channel. And of course, please do support me at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. So here is the Twitter thread. Let me see how this looks first. Okay, it's pretty big. So I said every June 4th, we hear from Western media propagandists, Western propagandists about the Tiananmen Square massacre. It's all meant to smear China. And I say that there was no massacre that took place during that time, okay? And that the violence that took place in Beijing was part of a failed cover revolution backed by the United States. And so I first go for what I think is probably the most controversial point, which is that 3 years prior to the Tiananmen Square incident, George Soros had started a non-governmental organization, an NGO, that had a good amount of influence in Beijing. It was called the Fund for Reform and Opening of China. And if you've been following George Soros of late, he is on a tear, right? Talking about how China did not go the way that he had hoped it went. He was hoping, probably through the founding of this organization, he was hoping that China would just open up completely and become a Western-style quote-unquote democracy, would open itself up for complete and utter plunder from foreign corporations, Western corporations, international finance, Wall Street, etc. That's what George Soros was hoping, and it didn't happen. So key leaders of this and the rioters, right, that existed during the Tiananmen Square protests or the Tiananmen Square massacre, just maybe not in the square, but in and around Beijing, were supported by this organization. And right after, right, this is August 8th, 1989, right after the Tiananmen Square incident, right after the China's government said that around 200 to 300 people were killed in Beijing through really violent events, half of which were Chinese soldiers, PLA, and police. They were killed by so-called rioters, people who had Molotov cocktails. They were burning vehicles. Right after all of this happened, right after June 5th, 1989, right after the whole so-called Tank Man incident, just a couple of months later, the fund was closed. George Soros's NGO, his so-called non-governmental organization, was kicked out of China. And here's the Washington Post headline that said the fund's representatives are arrested in China by Marianne Yen. So that's how China clamped down after this, because they realized that George Soros's money, the pro-democracy color revolution money that George Soros is well known to back, we know what he did in Eastern Europe, we know how he facilitated the Asia financial crisis, and we know how his largesse continues to fund big NGOs which have influence over political movements domestically and abroad, in the United States and abroad. So then I move on and say that Western media has portrayed this event as a Chinese government massacre, while journalists on the ground rejected this premise. But the Western media, almost in its entirety, ignore this. They ignore the fact that Graham Earnshaw of Reuters said he saw no violence in the square and said at least half the deaths that occurred were Chinese cops and soldiers. And there, here I cite from a source I'm actually going to pull up in a bit, that Reuters had found that this journalist who was writing for Reuters said he didn't leave the square until the morning of June 4th. And he wrote in his memoir that the military came, negotiated with the students, and made everyone, including himself, leave peacefully, that nobody died in the square. But did people die in China? Yes. And he says 200, 300 people died in clashes in various parts of Beijing around June 4th. So around it, so before and perhaps after. And about half those who died were soldiers and cops. And so here you have CBS News, right? There was no Tiananmen Square massacre. That was written by Richard Roth in 2009. And he said, we saw no bodies, injured people, ambulances, or medical personnel. In short, nothing to even suggest, let alone prove, that a massacre had occurred in Tiananmen Square. Quote, in BBC News in 2009, James Miles, quote, I was one of the foreign journalists who witnessed the events of that night. There was no massacre on Tiananmen Square. In the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, I'm sure you all know him. He is notorious for being an apologist of imperialism. He says on June 13th, 1989, he was at Beijing at the time. He said, quote, state television has even shown film of students marching peacefully away from Tiananmen Square shortly after dawn as proof that they were not slaughtered. In that article, he also debunked an unidentified student protester who had claimed in a sensational article that Chinese soldiers with machine guns simply mowed down peaceful protesters in Tiananmen Square. So, and then there's a Reuters piece. So anyway, mainstream media, this is all to say that mainstream media, Western media, has already basically proven and demonstrated that there's huge reasons to question this whole narrative that somehow China just mowed down protesters and students and conducted a massacre, right, on June 4th, 1989, during these so-called pro-democracy protests. So then I talk about the WikiLeaks cable, right? because this does corroborate exactly what the Western media had said in those various articles and exactly what the Chinese government has said. So this cable came from the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, and it also confirmed no violence here. And it was from a Chilean diplomat. So a Chilean diplomat essentially said that she was there and she didn't see any violence and that she saw protesters be able to come and go freely. And I believe she even wrote a book about it, but you can, don't quote me there. So then I follow up and say propaganda is vital to color revolutions. And we're going to play the full Tank Man video because I think it's very important, because this is something that goes around. It's like this quote unquote iconic image of what supposedly happened at the Tiananmen Square massacre, end quote. So I say we hear about Tank Man, right? But not that his actions occurred the day after June 4th, when the supposed massacre began, happened on June 5th, or that he left the scene unscathed without any violence from Chinese authorities, and that we can see this from the video of the incident. So I'm actually going to play this. I actually have to, I'm going to check to see if my audio is synced up. Let me know if you hear it, okay? I'm going to put my headphones on to prevent echo. So let's watch this full video. So there you have it, everyone. That's the full Tank Man video. Thanks to Carl Zaw for publishing that in its entirety. And as you see there, that's the full video. The PLA officers that were in that tank did not fire on him. They didn't come out and arrest him. They didn't do anything that could be considered violence. You even saw him climb on top of a tank. I mean, could you imagine doing that if you were to climb on top of the militarized police vehicles and the heavy sting, those that are carrying these heavy stingrays and other types of militarized weaponry. I don't know if you remember the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests, where the NYPD and other police departments across the country were mowing down protesters, literally mowing them down. And here you have the Tank Man video showing, right, that this was not a violent act, that the PLA officer was literally probably asking him, hey, please move out of the way. He ended up climbing on the tank. He climbed off of the tank. He kept following the tank as it was trying to move around him. One thing that isn't mentioned often, though, is how the tanks, there was a line of tanks, and they were actually moving away from Tiananmen Square. This was the day after the so-called massacre occurred. But you saw how people, just ordinary people, came up to him. Seemed like they were saying, hey, you should probably get out of the way of the tank so they can get through. And a group of them ended up wishing him away, saying, hey, let's get out of here. And that's all that happened, right? There was no follow-up. There's no evidence that the tanks followed him and then ended up shooting them all down, right? All this inherent maliciousness of the PLA and the Chinese government is basically contradicted by this full video. I couldn't even imagine doing such a thing in the United States when the United States is sending out its militarized National Guard, its militarized police departments on protesters. I mean, I couldn't imagine doing that without severe consequences, whether it's being violently beat down or at the very least immediately arrested, detained, and probably charged with some very serious crimes, because we know that a lot of Black Lives Matter protesters were charged with serious crimes. You remember that Buffalo protester, I think he was over the age of 70 years old, who was just walking the streets and the cops just pushed him down, cracked his head open. No consequences for them. I mean, this is the hypocrisy of the United States. This is the hypocrisy of the imperialists when they propagandize against China. They want to promote China as somehow more evil than they are. But if you watch the whole footage, you see that not only did this not occur on the so-called date of the Tiananmen Square quote-unquote massacre, but the tank man himself was not a victim of violence. There was no violence there. I have not seen any good and verifiable evidence that there was any such violence on the streets near Tiananmen or on the square during the protests or afterward. There's also another photo. It's funny. I'm not even going to show you the photo, but you've probably seen it where there's kind of it's like a hazy photo and you see a lot of bikes in the streets and you see a few maybe people lying down in the streets, supposedly indicating that tanks had shot them down or PLA had shot them down. But I tried to verify that photo many, many, many times. And the earliest version of that photo that I could find is from 2016. So seems pretty unlikely that that photo just suddenly leaked in 2016, that it was somehow hidden from the public domain when this supposedly occurred many decades before that, more than two decades before that. So nonetheless, I just wanted to show you the Tank Man and show you how ridiculous it is. And then I go on to say that there were no major clashes between peaceful protesters and authorities during the so-called Tiananmen Square incident. The Tank Man propaganda really does conceal other images, right? So other images, as I say, that there was violence in Beijing at the time in and around the incident, or I mean around the incident before and perhaps a bit afterward. And I show these pictures. So these are PLA soldiers sitting with the protesters having exchange and dialogue. As you can see here, none of these PLA soldiers are armed. I don't know if you can see that, but none of them are armed. They're huddled together. There's stories about them singing together during the protests in an act of unity, even if there were disagreements. So it's important to show these images. And this was actually before the Tiananmen Square incident, where just ordinary people were giving food to PLA soldiers, contradicting this idea that everybody was scared of the PLA and that the PLA was getting ready to mow down ordinary Chinese people. So those are just a few images you'll never see in the corporate media be shared when talking about Tiananmen Square. And so I ended the thread just by saying that since the 1989 June 4th incident, China has accomplished major achievements, elimination of extreme poverty, massive wage growth to the point where corporations like Apple no longer say that it's a low-wage country, global leadership in high technology, AI, quantum computing, 5G technology, you name it, public infrastructure development. We're talking about high-speed rail. We're talking about public transit. We're talking about all sorts of various, you know, new housing developments, new bridges, all new infrastructure that's constantly going up in China and in the investment in the public domain. And then, of course, renewable energy, where China is really unmatched in terms of both its consumption and its investment and production of it. So the West's pursuit, however, of endless war and color revolutions continues. Right, because this was a color revolution, and I wanted to just share that thread. It's kind of a brief summary, and now I'm going to share another source. Okay, another source that's kind of going to give a little bit more of a background and a little a bit more specifics about this so-called massacre. Okay, and it's one of my favorites. Actually, I believe it's Australian social workers who put this together. And they put together a few of their own kind of like research in this. And it's just a good way to get it all in one place. And they call Tiananmen Square student massacre a hoax. And I tend to agree with them. So it's Milton James. This is the Critical Social Work Publishing House. They are just a few social workers who just put these resources together. They've mainly focused on Australia and that region and sort of debunking some propaganda. Okay, so this is a really good resource, and I put it in the description below. And so, you know, they talk about how in Australia, the ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Commission, right, they talk about the Tiananmen Square massacre all of the time. And what if it never happened, though, right? And so they cite that on June 22nd, 2019, a World Affairs website blog, Tiananmen Square Facts, Fiction, and Propaganda, which I'm going to just scroll down now too, because it has all of the resources summarized for all of you. And I think it's really good in this way. And it goes over some interesting specifics. So here you see that as far as can be determined from the available evidence, no one died that night in Tiananmen Square, right? And he says, what? Who would make such a blatant propagandist claim? Was it China's Communist Party? Nope. It was Jay Matthews, who was Washington Post's Beijing bureau chief in 1989, and he wrote it in the Columbia Journalism Review. And so here are a few examples, more examples that I already had cited, right? CBS News, there was no Tiananmen Square massacre. BBC News, there was no Tiananmen Square massacre. Nicholas Kristof saying he saw students marching peacefully away from Tiananmen Square shortly after dawn on television. And then you have Graham, as he was there in Beijing, said Reuters said Graham Earnshaw was in Tiananmen Square on the night of June 3rd, and he didn't leave until the morning of June 4th. And he wrote about the military negotiating that nobody had died in the square, and that about 200, 300 people did die in Beijing, about half were soldiers. And then there's the WikiLeaks cable, the Latin American diplomat and his wife. So a Chilean diplomat and his wife said they were able to enter and leave Tiananmen Square several times and were not harassed by troops, remaining with students until the final withdrawal. The diplomat said there were no mass shootings in the square or the monument. That's what the WikiLeaks cable said from the leaked documents from the Beijing, the U.S. Embassy in Beijing, which was sent in July of 1989, just the following month from the so-called massacre. And then, you know, the tank man. We already looked at that video, jumping on the tanks, walking away unharmed. There's no picture or videos of actually soldiers shooting or killing people, but it's something to keep in mind. They say it doesn't mean it didn't happen, but it's something to keep in mind. And so exaggeration, but omission, you know, you rarely see the pictures of military vehicles that were burned down that day or in and around that day, because this will demonstrate how restrained the military was. Here's a slideshow of military buses, armored vehicles, and tanks being burned by the peaceful protesters. So here you see a picture of military vehicles that were burned down. You know, they didn't catch on fire. They were burned down. And it's very hard for just ordinary people who are peacefully protesting to be able to do such a thing unless they are armed, unless they have the ability to do so. It says sometimes the soldiers were allowed to escape and sometimes they were brutally killed by the so-called protesters. Numerous protesters were armed with Molotov cocktails and even guns. In an article on June 5th, 1989, the Wall Street Journal described some of this violence. Quote, dozens of soldiers were pulled from trucks. Dozens of soldiers were pulled from trucks, severely beaten and left for dead. At an intersection west of the square, the body of a young soldier who had been beaten to death was stripped naked and hung from the side of the bus. And that is a trigger warning. I can barely look at that. I'm just going to scroll through. But I just want to let you know and see that this was definitely more complex than just peaceful protesters being quote unquote mowed down. So how could the protesters kill so many soldiers? Because until the very end, soldiers in China were unarmed. Most of the times they didn't even have helmets or batons. And here's the photo that I had shared on my Twitter. So what exactly happened then, right? Let's go over what happened. So we have to understand important people, Hu Yaobang and James Lilly. Hu Yaobang was the chairman and general secretary of the Communist Party of China in 1989, but he was a reformer and he died on April 15th. Without his death, there probably would not have been any unrest in China. College students initially gathered at Tiananmen Square only to mourn his death. Within a day or two of Yaobang's death, the U.S. realized that hundreds of thousands of young people would be congregating in Beijing. It was the perfect time for a coup, since the rest of the world was dismantling communism that year. So the perfect time for a color revolution. This isn't the first time, and we'll talk about that, but this isn't the first time that a color revolution was attempted by the United States. So on April 28, 1989, 5 days after Yaobang's death, James Lilly was appointed as the U.S. ambassador to China, and he was a 30-year veteran of the CIA. So there you go. The CIA is ready to intervene and to try to take advantage of the situation. So an article from the Vancouver Sun in 1992 described the role of the CIA. Quote, the Central Intelligence Agency had sources among Tiananmen Square protesters. And for months before the protests, the CIA had been helping student activists form the anti-government movement. To help U.S. intelligence, there were two important people, George Soros and Zhao Ziyang. Soros is legendary for organizing grassroots movements around the world, and in 1986, he donated $1 million, which is a lot of money in China in those days. Remember, everybody, that still the RMB, even in 2022, is still about six. The ratio is about one US dollar to about six or seven RMB. That may change very quickly in the coming years, but still, imagine what it was like when China was much poorer in 1989, when it barely had a heavy industry. So Soros, as I said, over the next 3 years after he founded the Fund for the Reform of Opening of China with $1 million, the group cultivated and trained many pro-democracy student leaders who would spring into action in 1989. The NED, the National Endowment for Democracy, also opened offices in China in 1988, and it's another regime change organization. Now, before I move on, I want to show you all, I'm going to kind of bounce back to the source, something that I had found after I read that, because I was like, okay, I want a little bit more. So during the Tiananmen Square protest, during this incident, right, there was an organization that was heavily cited by the Western media as one of the leaders of the unrest, and that was the Beijing Workers Autonomous Federation. Think of this organization at like the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions, which is an NED-funded so-called trade union, mainly of professionals, petty bourgeois classes, people kind of outside the industrial working class, outside of essentially the majority of the people in Hong Kong. Same goes for the Beijing Workers Autonomous Federation. It was not the union. It's not the All China People's Federation of Trade Unions, which is the main trade union in China, which organizes many of the industrial workers. This is was something independent in and of itself. And actually, it led a lot of the riots in China, this organization. So I wanted to look up this organization. Let me just share what I found, because this National Endowment for Democracy connection is very important, okay? So I found a Voice of America. So if you know don't know Voice of America, it is a U.S. agency for global media-funded media outlets, state-affiliate, you could call it U.S. state-affiliated media, which U.S. Agency for Global Media, formerly Board of Broadcasting Governors, was a CIA operation in order to promote anti-communist ideas around the world. And so now they are institutionalized even further with congressional funding. So here it says 30 years after Tiananmen, China still suspicious. Okay. So I looked up the word autonomous here, suspicious of student labor ties. And here you have exactly who I was talking about. So it says Han Dongfeng was one of the leaders of the Beijing Workers' Autonomous Federation, which was founded during the Tiananmen protests and was part of a short-lived effort to create China's first independent trade union, supposedly. So this was an organization very crucial in the riots and the unrest. And so Han tells VOA that the calls for equal distribution of wealth sounds great, right? And more democratic representation in the workplace continue and are being manifest and blah, blah, and strikes. So here's the important thing. So he says corruption has now been exposed, he says. Han later went on to found the China Labor Bulletin. So what is the China Labor Bulletin? Is that a legitimate grassroots organization? Is that an organization which is legitimately fighting for the interests of the workers in China? Not exactly. The China Labor Bulletin was founded by none other than the National Endowment for Democracy in Hong Kong, which Hong Kong is part of China, don't get me wrong, but it was founded in Hong Kong, right? And here you have Free Trade Union Institute from the National Endowment for Democracy, the grants that it provided over $436,000, which went to support the work of labor activists both inside of China and in exile, including the monthly publication of the Chinese language China Labor Bulletin. So this gentleman, right, this Han Dongfeng, that was one of the leaders of the Beijing Workers' Autonomous Federation, which was causing a lot of this unrest during Tiananmen in 1989, was then able to secure a pretty lucrative gig founding the China Labor Bulletin with National Endowment for Democracy money. There it is. There it is. The grant, the money. That is who this gentleman serves. That's what the Beijing Workers' Autonomous Federation, that's who they were serving. So it's pretty obvious that there are some pretty deep connections here. So we need to look at that and see that, yeah, there was some, there was definitely some bad faith, definitely some foul play here on the part of the United States' shadow war network, right? This color revolution network. So back to the resource I was reading from before, from the Critical Social Work Publishing House. So who'd allow all these Western fake NGOs? It was Zhao Ziyang, who was the premier of China at the time and the general secretary of the Communist Party. He was a big fan of privatization and Milton Friedman. His close advisor, Chen Yiji, headed China's Institute for Economic and Structural Reform, an influential neoliberal think tank. After the protests, Soros' NGO were banned in China. Zhao Ziyang was purged and placed under house arrest for the rest of his life, and Chen Yiji escaped to America. So after the protests, there was a lot of changes, obviously, that had to occur in order to protect the integrity of China's sovereignty, and that's exactly what happened. So then, this is a little bit of speculation, but Gene Sharp perhaps played a role in the Tiananmen Square protests. He wrote a book, How to Start a Revolution, all about color revolutions He was in Beijing for 9 days during the protests and wrote about it. He didn't reveal his role, but it's not hard to imagine that he was working closely with the Pentagon, the CIA, the NED, because for decades he had been fermenting uprisings all around the world. And then you can find an in-depth article on him. So he was there as well, seemingly playing a monitoring role, but it's unclear, and we should be very skeptical about why he was there. So here you see some of the pro-US Western propaganda, give me democracy or give me death, that was present there, showing that there obviously was a huge Western influence over a huge section of these so-called protests. So it's really also to be noted that the Chinese government had not imposed martial law until May 20th, and that and there was no major clashes between the military and the people until the very end. Here's a picture of protesters giving food to Chinese soldiers. So there you see that there obviously wasn't completely ill feelings between the PLA and the students, and that they were not a monolithic group, that the students were not just one force all united around the same thing. You had those who were kind of sick of economic malaise and the rising prices of consumer goods and food and college tuition going up and the liberalization that was really placing some downward pressure on their potential livelihoods. You had idealistic young people who really did want democracy, free speech, free press. Maybe they had been influenced by Western ideas, not just because of reform and opening up, but also because, I mean, at this time, you did have the fall of socialism occurring. You had the Soviet Union really on the brink of collapse by 1989, and you had the Eastern Bloc on the brink of collapse. You just really had a dire situation for the world socialist movement. And so that means that it's possible that Western ideas can infiltrate and affect consciousness, especially among students and intellectuals who tend to already have that tendency. And now most people don't know about the CIA's Operation Yellowbird, which supposedly, right, it was all about what happened after Tiananmen. And so a lot of these top student leaders had escaped from China with the help of the CIA right after the protest and went to the U.S. They went to colleges like Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, and they got generous help from the U.S. government. So obviously, if we can't necessarily pinpoint the direct help of the U.S. government, the CIA, during and before the protest, we can see that they were facilitating their migration to so-called safety after the protests. And so even though they might have been in the minority, there were provocateurs who significantly escalated tensions. There was violence. You can see here someone with a gun, right? There was one of the student leaders, Chai Ling, said during an interview, "I wanted to tell them that we were expecting bloodshed and that it would take a massacre which would spill blood like a river through Tiananmen Square to awaken the people. How could I tell them this? How could I tell them that their lives would be sacrificed in order to win?" She escaped from China a couple of days before June 4th, 1989. So you had some people who were looking for violence, right? Looking for violent confrontation with the government, which can never really lead to anything but violence and hardship. So there you have it. You have China's leader, you know, they're not great at soft power, as they said. I understand that criticism. I hear it all the time. And I think that it's somewhat valid, somewhat, I think, goes against some things, both culturally regarding China, but also about its system, and also in terms of like, what do you really spend your time doing, right? Better the Chinese people's condition, or do you get into open conflict with imperialists? So sometimes those two things are really antagonistic toward each other, right? The Soviet Union learned the hard way that when you are perceived to be a direct threat, you end up having to spend a lot of resources, right, on the military and in proxy conflicts in order to just survive. And that really did hurt the Soviet Union, all of the ways in which it was forced to participate in an arms race, and China has always attempted to avoid that. So there you go. You know, that's just some background, okay, of this incident. There's one more thread from a great person on Twitter, Asian Bogan. I like him. He's or them or her. I don't know the gender of the person, but I do want to just say that you can say, see, it's not even that difficult to debunk this because the claims are so wild. We don't have any proof of verification that Chinese soldiers were massacring people in the streets. You saw the pictures there of how perhaps U.S.-backed, NGO-backed, so-called rioters and protesters were actually conducting violence. And where have we seen this before, right? Even just in recent years, Nicaragua, 2018, Venezuela, 2014, and then a few times after that, right? You've seen over and over and over again the U.S. sponsoring violence, Ukraine, 2014, right? Just over and over and over again, you see it, the color revolutions, the attempts to violently overthrow a government via proxy. You saw it in Syria, you saw it in Libya. And then when the conditions are right, or you know, should we say ripe, correct, for the United States, then they bring in NATO, they bring in the military, they bring in the guns in order to finish the job. With China, that was not possible because of all the contradictions that this article kind of made mention of, right? There wasn't necessarily a monolithic unity among the students. There was a lot of different grievances. China's People's Liberation Army was not universally hated. There wasn't necessarily any massive danger to the legitimacy of the state. And so the violence that did occur, well, it still remains a very sensitive issue in China, one that their people are not proud of. Nonetheless, there was, and people in China, they view it like this. They view it as an open attack, like an act of war. And so a lot they don't choose to want to talk about it because it's one of these dark moments that I think really doesn't have anything productive to offer, because the side that was sponsoring the unrest, those forces that were sponsoring the unrest, they didn't have anything tangible to actually improve the situation. It only led to unnecessary bloodshed and violence. And a lot of PLA, I mean, these are human beings, right? People in the PLA, the police killed along with, you know, civilians. And that was a really dark day. But at the same time, the propaganda around it has only served to create an even further atmosphere of war, an even more intense atmosphere of war. It's very counterproductive, not just counterproductive, but dangerous, because it sends an image of China to the world. It sends an image to China for people in the United States and everywhere else that China is attempting to kill its own people, that it's done it before, and that that means that it is actually capable of conducting violence in a way that could threaten the United States and people all around the world. And that's the kind of image that this, the new Cold Warriors, the neocons, the military industrial complex, that's the kind of image they want of China, because it's their anti-communist orientation. It's their capitalist and imperialist interests, which really drive aggression toward China. So I want to share one more thread before closing this out. Asian Bogan, this person is very good. And it's another kind of summary. I did put this thread in the description as well. So let me just scroll all the way up, because there's another part of this that I want to show you all. So Asian Bogan said, today, June 4th, you'll be reminded of a massacre of Tiananmen Square, the Tank Man photo on June 5th, or the image below on June 3rd by the same photographer, right? So here's a link to the resources debunking the mainstream narrative. And I want to get into this photo as well, because here you see someone burning a tank, okay? So WikiLeaks, no bloodshed inside Tiananmen Square, according to a cable. And then they cite the cable, which we won't read. It's pretty long. Richard Roth, there was no Tiananmen Square massacre. They say CBS News, the Tiananmen massacre was a myth, remembering British lies, IB Times in the UK. What really happened at Tiananmen? Another source. Japan Times, right? These are just out there. Then Deidre Griswold of Workers' World talks about it as a myth. Dissident Voice, massacre, what massacre? Right? So over and over and over again, the Columbia Journalism Review, the myth of Tiananmen that was cited earlier in the other resource, Tiananmen Square and the Threat of Counter-Revolution, Yannicka Cortez over at Liberation News, PSL. And PSL also wrote the massacre that wasn't. So there's a lot of resources out there, guys. It's not, this isn't new stuff, all right? So, you know, Hong Kong in 1994, ATV broadcast broke down the timeline of the clearance of Tiananmen Square on the morning of June 4, 1989 with footage recorded by a Spain RTV crew. Footage of the mainstream media won't show you because it doesn't fit the massacre narrative. So there you go again. You see that the clearance of Tiananmen Square was not a massacre, just as the diplomat, the Chilean diplomat had said as well. So the story here of the video, right? I want to look at this. It's from the first image of the thread. Jeff Widener explains the night of June 3rd being struck by a brick from a protester and how a soldier was lynched by the mob after. He took the tank man image on the 5th of June from his hotel because he was recovering from the June 3rd injury. So I'm going to play this video for you all. So this is the person who took the tank man. This is the person who took the tank man photo, right? The so-called iconic photo that shows repression. And he was himself a victim of the rioters, right? That were likely sponsored by the West. So here you go. I'm going to play this for you all.
One man was on the ground, on fire, rolling around. Another man was helping him. And I'm just going, come on, come on, come on. And the flash would not recycle. And I'm waiting, which seemed to be an eternity. And I lifted it to my eye. And the minute I lifted it to my eye, my neck snapped back. I looked down, blood's all over me. And I had a massive concussion from a brick from a protester had thrown. And I looked at the back of the armored car that was on fire. And this is now getting very close to midnight. And then out came a soldier to surrender. He had his hands up in the air. And I still remember that pristine look of his uniform, how pressed it was. It was clear as day in my mind. I remember it so clearly. And the mob looked at him for a second, and then they slowly moved in, and they had pipes, and they had weapons of all kinds, and they started beating on him. And I looked at that, and I couldn't take a picture. And I thought to myself, I'm going to lose the Pulitzer Prize. And then I thought to myself, I should be ashamed for thinking something like that because he's about to die.
Sorry about that. I was muted. Oh my gosh. All right, guys. My apologies. So I was just saying that there you had it with the BBC journalist worried about his Pulitzer Prize as he's being knocked in the head with a brick and injured. He's worrying about that while not even questioning, well, why are these protesters being so violent? Why is he at this scene? Like, what's happening here, right? I mean, this is the narcissism, this like imperialist narcissism, this hubris, that there's not even any reflection, right? I mean, hearing him talk, it's almost like, dude, you just got hit in the head with a brick by protesters who are supposed to be peaceful and on your side. And they're just like, the unrest is just like, it's like anarchistic. It just has, seems like it has no purpose, and you could have died there, but I guess your Pulitzer Prize just means way more than your life. It's just incredible. So, but there you have it. You know, Asian Bogan's thread is a good one because it has all of those resources that I was scrolling through. Can't read them all, but they basically will essentially make the same point. And the point is, that the protests happened directly after the death of a major figure of the Communist Party of China. And they happened as there was major investment from people like George Soros, and this isn't a Soros conspiracy theory. This is just an acknowledgement that George Soros, one of the richest men in the world, and also one of the most anti-communist forces in the world, has funded, has organized, and has gathered resources for color revolutions, and had been doing so since the beginning of the fall of the Soviet Union for many, many, many years, helped orchestrate that. I won't say there's a primary force, but had influence in the fall of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Eastern Bloc, was literally one of the singular reason for the Asia financial crisis, because of his hedge fund and what it did to the currencies in Asia. And he had an organization that was open there that had close ties to certain liberal, shall we say, pro-capitalist elements within China's government. And it seemed like there was an attempt by the liberalizers and the so-called mega reformers, we could call them, you know, they still call them liberals in China, people who really do want to see, it's a small section, but when they are backed by money, as they were in this instance, and I showed you that there was a National Endowment for Democracy tie to the founder of the, one of the founders, leaders of the Beijing Workers Autonomous Federation, supposedly calling for labor reforms in China. He ended up founding with NED money, another organization many years later, right? You have this money swirling around. You have a kind of this color revolution feeling in the air on the world scale. And it led to this moment, which did have violence associated with it. It just wasn't happening on the square during the protests, that the PLA, I mean, the resolve of the PLA, the I think just shows the strength of China's socialist system and its governance system, the resolve to be able to maintain kind of a peaceful posture, even tank man. I mean, I can't even imagine what the US police forces, what the US military would do to someone who climbed on their tank. You just see over and over again how ridiculous the propaganda is, and how if you look at the deaths, even Western media sources say that those deaths that occurred likely beginning June 3rd and into the 4th and 5th, most of them, if not half or more, were soldiers and police. So there were clashes with rioters, kind of like what happened in Hong Kong. The Hong Kong model was definitely spurred from the Tiananmen Square model. You know, they're kind of like Hong Kong, where these so-called protesters, a lot of them were committing violence and doing it to ordinary people and actually terrorizing the police, if you can believe it. I mean, this is the inverted reality that the propagandists create, right? Like, they try to project onto China everything that is wrong with the United States, everything that's wrong with imperialism. And then when you actually look at the reality, the non-inverted reality, just the material reality, you see that the situation was actually much different. And there's probably no bigger event that demonstrates this than the Tiananmen Square so-called massacre that really wasn't. So I wanted to go over all of that with you today. I think I've spent, what, the last 45, 50 minutes doing that with all of you, because it's one of these events that it's always trending on Twitter. There's always comments about this, and people double down, the anti-China reactionaries, the China hawks, they double down on this moment as kind of like a smoking gun as to why China and the Communist Party of China are quote-unquote authoritarian, quote-unquote violent, a threat, and how it's organized to suppress the will of the people, the interests of the people. And this is done to negate basically everything that's happened in China since 1949. It's to negate all the accomplishments, all the achievements, all the ways in which the Chinese people actually support their government. And it's done to just help the China hawks, the new Cold Warriors, gain ideological foothold with Americans, with Europeans, with Westerners, and with all of those who are willing to do the bidding of the war machine. So that's what Tiananmen Square is all about. That's why it's so sensitive in China, because the stakes are very high. And this was a moment where there was such resources poured into a color revolution moment that it did lead to open clashes with the government. And as you see now, with China's current policy and how they treated and handled the Hong Kong situation, no more, right? This is not going to happen. And this is not something that's going to be repeated, that this is something that's going to be addressed, and that it's going to be treated as it should be, which is as a dark moment in history, and one that can only be reconciled through a real policy, both to defend sovereignty and to better the conditions of the Chinese people. And that's how China has kind of moved since then. That's how it has operated since this moment. And it's important to remember the propaganda, to go over it, to debunk it, and to then move forward and build a real movement for solidarity, self-determination, and one that defends sovereignty, international law, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the Tiananmen Square incident, guys. I'm going to move on now, because there's one other thing I want to go over. But all the new folks who are here, please do like the stream. Please do subscribe to the channel. Hit that notifications bell. And I'm still about a couple $100 per month shy of my goal for 2022, my financial goal to help keep this work sustainable. If I meet this goal, I'll be able to do so many more things. I definitely want to put some money to the side to just maybe pay someone to help me a little bit, because I need some help with this stuff. So please do subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. That's patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. It's in the description of this video, as well as many other options if you enjoy Substack a lot more. It's where I publish a lot of my articles. If you enjoy supporting me in other ways, you can do so below. But Patreon is the main way. So with that said, I want to go over one more thing. I hope that the Tiananmen Square review that I did was satisfactory, okay? Because it's a lot. And I wanted to just summarize some of the key points, the interference aspect, right, from U.S. and Western imperialism, as well as just some of these key propaganda points which need to be debunked. So I hope that that was sufficient. And there's many more resources in the description of this video, which you can spread around to help also bring about kind of a change in consciousness around this issue. So with that said, one last thing. All right, guys, one last thing. So Marianne Williamson, right? I've gone into arguments with Marianne Williamson during Afghanistan, right? I mean, she's a Democrat, and, you know, to be honest, getting into fights with Democrats, with like liberals, it can be exhausting, and I don't do it, and I didn't do it here, but I want to show you something that I want to comment on. I did do it during the whole Afghanistan withdrawal debacle. It doesn't usually go well in terms of the response. So I just wanted to show you all kind of my response. She didn't respond to me, but she recently posted something I thought was interesting, and I think indicative of what's wrong with the Democratic Party mindset, the liberal mindset in America. Because I think what we are seeing right now is just a monumental political crisis. And we're seeing how the political establishment and all of those forces, people like Marianne Williamson and those who follow her, they don't understand, and they don't want to understand, because I think they have a vested interest in the system, but they don't understand how this political crisis really speaks to the need for a political alternative, a real grassroots independent vehicle that working class people can hop in, join in, and assert real political power through, in order to place pressure on the establishment. But a lot of these forces, a lot of the liberals, a lot of the Democrats, all of them really, they are still attached to the Democratic Party apparatus. They don't want to let go of it. And I think this is the most egregious way and one of the more egregious examples of how this mindset really does produce what I think is such utter cognitive dissonance and really dangerous, just a dangerous political orientation that places us at worst in a dead end. It really does place us and our movements in a political graveyard, right? And that's what the Democratic Party is. So Marianne Williamson says here that they've been talking about a red wave in the midterms for so long, but the decision to repeal Roe v. Wade and Uvalde aftermath should change that. The people need to rise up against fascism, even when the party that should be doing so far more vigorously refuses to do so. So this is her saying that the Republicans are fascism. And look, I'm not going to argue about the reactionary character of the Republican Party. It's not a working class party. It's been the white man's party, as Glenn Ford said, for two and a half generations, really, right? Ever since the so-called civil rights movement. So, I mean, think about that, right? It's not a progressive party. It's not a working class party. I don't care what anyone in the Republican Party says. It's not. But to say it's fascism is, to me, a real stretch. I think that it really bastardizes and sanitizes the word fascism. But I love this response by O'Connor class. You can't vote out fascism. Because she's saying, Marianne Williamson, that the party that should be doing so, meaning the Democratic Party, refuses to do so. Okay, you can't vote out fascism. And then she says, you absolutely can. You absolutely can vote out fascism, says Marianne Williamson. Now, all I said, and I don't know if it'll show here. Yeah, I say here, if fascism can be voted out, why was a world war needed to defeat it? Could you share an example of when fascism was voted out? And some people are saying Bolivia was a recent example on our side here, but Chavez was elected, blah, blah, blah. Okay. And a Mussolini, which is not factually correct. So there are people trying to own, but she didn't respond to me. But the point is that Marianne Williamson believes that you can vote out fascism. So let me just address that Bolivia criticism, right? Oh, well, I'm here with you. Well, Bolivia, I think the movement towards socialism is way more than just about electing out the fascist coup, right? And to say that the government was fascist or like there was a fascist character in Bolivia just because of that coup, I think is just a huge stretch, because the coup obviously was illegitimate and it did not have the popular support of a fascist movement. There were fascists who believed themselves to be in a fascist movement who were committing violence. I'm not negating that. But to say Bolivia's government after that coup was fascist, I think undermines the legitimacy of the movement towards socialism and why it was able to unelect the coup government, right? Why it was able to overthrow it, because there was already a structure in place which disallowed that fascist coup to remain, right? Despite the fact that Bolivia in that movement towards socialism doesn't really have control over its military and police, doesn't have really the support of them as much as maybe it would want. So nonetheless, right, fascism is a huge stretch to call Bolivia. But the point here is that Marianne Williamson is talking about the United States. And what she is saying is that the Republican Party is fascism, the Democratic Party should be electing it out, and that we can help them do so. So basically what she's saying is that we need to support the Democratic Party to elect out fascism. She's supposed to be to the left, right, the left wing of the Democratic Party. But basically, she's just repeating the narrative of the neoliberals who, during the Trump era, was saying, well, we need to elect out Trump because he's fascist and we're not. What that leads us to is actually, I think, the road to actual fascism, if we're not already there, because essentially what fascism thrives off of, one, the destruction of a communist and socialist movement, right? Fascism is about repression. It's about total repression. It's about resolving the class war totally, right? It's about destroying any alternative. So fascism thrives off of that. And fascism is really the consolidation of capitalism in its most violent form to maintain and protect its hegemony, right? To maintain and protect its profits, its interests. And it's when the capitalists basically say, well, the only way to do that is by clamping down in the most extreme forms, take away all the bourgeois freedoms, take away as much as we can in order to reproduce this system in a time usually of crisis. The crisis usually coming from a strong socialist movement encroaching toward power, or and economic crisis leading to mass disillusionment, leading to mass dissatisfaction. And so Marianne Williams's orientation here actually helps out both of these, I think, kind of, how should I say, catalysts for fascism. Because by saying that we need to support the Democratic Party, she's spreading mass disillusionment, because the Democratic Party has nothing to offer working class people. So the Democratic Party, the Biden administration now, this tiny majority they have in Congress, has delivered absolutely nothing, right? You could nitpick and say, oh, they delivered something. But I'm talking about tangible improvements of people's lives. Even the child tax credit that the COVID package, right, the American Recovery Act or whatever it was, put into place, that ended in a very short period of time. So that child poverty that was reduced has just come soaring back. And now with inflation and all of this, I'm sure that it's even worse. But the economic situation is a catastrophe. U.S. foreign policy is a catastrophe with the Russia-Ukraine conflict and the U.S.'s addiction to prolonging it, sending billions upon billions. I mean, we're heading toward $100 billion by the time this is over, whenever that is. But it's heading in that direction of U.S. invest military aid and investment in Ukraine to fight Russia. I mean, Joe Biden has no plans on doing anything about gun violence, has no plans to do anything about inflation, is telling us so, is saying there's no predictions on whether this will get better, when it will get better. I mean, that's who Marianne Williamson is telling us to support. That's the Democratic Party. That's who she's telling us to support. So what is that going to foster other than mass disillusionment? We have it now. Mass disillusionment amid what is a fledging, if not already an economic crisis, because we just had an economic crisis 2020, arguably 2019 into 2020. And now there's this really dire economic situation that could be called a crisis. So you have the crisis, you have the mass disillusionment being spread, and by default, you have suppression, maybe not the suppression, although it is happening, right? Of socialists and communists, it is happening. It's always happening in the United States, political prisoners, the ways in which revolutionary organizations are still surveilled and suppressed more than anyone else. But even more, I think, powerful is how the soft power of the Democratic Party, by tampering down expectations and by creating a there is no alternative, the TINA neoliberal model, right, in the political realm, by creating this idea that the Democratic Party is all that there is, that hurts the ability of socialists, of working class organizations to gain any kind of foothold with the masses, therefore generating kind of this perfect environment for fascism. And so Marianne Williamson here is basically helping lay the basis for that. And I think that it's worth noting, because this is the mentality that we are going to be facing day in and day out leading into November, the midterm elections, and then leading into the 2024 election. We're going to be told by these so-called progressives, quote unquote, that we need to vote for the Democrats. They're going to have their so-called laundry list of things that they want. And they're going to say, well, if we vote for the Democrats and we give them their support, then once they have all of this so-called power and majorities, that they're going to do what we want. And we're going to be there watching this happen. And we're going to see how it doesn't work. And we're just going to get more of the same. And the misery is going to worsen. Do you see what I'm getting at here? That it doesn't, that it's just not any kind of solution that we should be striving for, and that it does lay the basis for fascism. And that is very, very, very dangerous. So Marianne Williamson, sometimes I think that, you know, she has a pretty big following. I have a good friend who loves her. She is close with a lot of people who we would consider Bernie Sanders leftists or people, Sandernistas, people who supported Bernie Sanders and the squad, etc. She has a lot of relationships with those forces. But I think Mary Williamson, to her credit, she really does demonstrate through what I think is actually quite, I'm not going to call her courageous, but I'm going to say that I give her credit for actually putting these ideas out without any hesitation. Because we see that a lot of the Bernie Sanders contingent, a lot of the squad contingent, they kind of get mealy mouth. They kind of try to beat around the bush. They try to move around politics. They try not to say what they mean. They try to avoid a lot of issues. But Marianne Williamson, she will take to Twitter and she will tell you that Biden is doing a horrible job with the withdrawal in Afghanistan because the United States needs to do more militarily because this is a moral question, right? She'll literally say we need to just continue the war in Afghanistan just on the basis of morality, quote unquote, or she'll take the Twitter as she did here and say, well, you just need to vote out the Republicans because we need to support Democrats if we're going to avoid fascism, right? And she is just more than willing to do that. So it actually brings sort of these teachable moments. So I guess I just want to thank Mary Williamson for bringing these teachable moments for us to dissect and analyze, because I think we do need to talk about this and think about this and act upon this and challenge this, because it's going to be something we see over and over and over again with people like Mary Williamson, people she's close to. She has a lot of connections. People keep her close. And look, I think we need a broad movement of the working class. We need to work with everyone we can on things that we agree with. But I also think that when there are antagonistic contradictions that emerge, when there are these antagonisms that cannot be reconciled just by saying we agree to disagree, I think this is one of them, then we have to come out and challenge it. And that's what this is, right? Because you can't vote for the Democrats. Voting for the Democrats and just sitting on your hands is a waste of time. Honestly, I'm not going to vote shame anyone. You want to vote for the Democrats as an individual, go ahead. But by claiming that this is some kind of collective response that is satisfactory is very dangerous. It is going to do what the Democrats have been very successful in doing, which is neutralizing movements by channeling them into the Democratic Party. And we are going to be in a worse situation because the Democratic Party, whenever it gets power, quote unquote, majorities in Congress or whatever, what does it do? Well, it essentially completely and entirely betrays the interests of the working class movement. It does nothing for working class people. And actually, it becomes a more effective evil of imperialism. It actually can do things that Republicans can't do. And some people take issue with this, but I would like to just say, for those who take issue with this conclusion, tell me how Donald Trump or even George W. Bush would be able to wage this proxy war against Russia. Wouldn't it have been possible? The entire establishment would have seen this as a blunder, as something that they couldn't allow Donald Trump to run and manage. I mean, it would have happened probably in some form if the time and circumstances were correct, which they weren't under Donald Trump. But nonetheless, it would have been a different situation. You would not have had a unilateral situation where Donald Trump could risk this, especially the economic catastrophe with what's going on in Ukraine, and be able to get out unscathed. It would be totally used as an opportunity to undermine his so-called authority, because that's what a big part of the establishment was doing, because they didn't like Donald Trump because he embarrassed them and he wasn't them. He wasn't of their ilk. You know, he wasn't a neocon. He wasn't this or that. He was dangerous. I think Donald Trump did a lot of really bad, awful things during his administration, just like any U.S. president does. He escalated things where he was demanded to escalate them. And, he was a U.S. president. And of course, he was praised when he took the moves that the establishment wanted him, the foreign policy establishment wanted him to do at the time. bombing Syria, dropping the Afghanistan bomb, all that kind of stuff, you know, escalating against Venezuela. Those things were good. You know, those things were cool. But I find it hard to believe that Trump would have had the same success as Biden is having in corralling Europe, in being able to wage this proxy war against Russia and all the damage that it has caused in the same way that Biden has been able to, right? Because Biden's on all of their teams. Biden is someone that, despite his incompetence, can be relied upon to just do what he's told. And while that doesn't mean that Trump was progressive in any kind of way, it does mean that this narrative that voting in a Democrat is just going to do us so much better must be challenged, right? Must be challenged. U.S. presidents, regardless of what party they're in, they all work for the same interests, and the only differences emerge based on circumstances, right? Based on political conditions, economic conditions, but really based upon the two-party duopoly con, right? Where they show slight ideological differences in order to distract from their bipartisan unity on endless war and austerity. So that's, I think, where Marion Williamson really is incorrect here. And to say you can vote out fascism so flippantly, I think, should give us pause and should have us reflect on, well, what are the material conditions that lead to fascism? What is fascism? Is fascism just, you know, a further right element of the ruling class? Is it just the Republican Party? Or is it something a lot more complex, which required a world war, a class war to defeat? And it will take another class war to defeat its reemergence, I guess, on the global scale. But it will also take a class war to defeat the rudiments of it that we see in places like Ukraine and the United States, right? We'll take a class war to defeat it, to eradicate it. We need our own campaign of denazification within our movements, and we cannot be distracted by the Democratic Party's graveyard of social movements. We can't be distracted by the Democratic Party's tendency to essentially suppress everything that we do in the name of beating back the Republicans, right? In the name of fear. We need to overcome that fear. We need to address that fear. We need to organize people into confronting that fear. We need to push back against this fear, which only gets us into worse and worse and worse situations politically, economically, etc. Every time that we end up in this situation. So I'm going to end the content there, guys, and just spend the next few minutes on any questions that you have. And and on super chats, thanking you all for the super chats. So please do, while you're here, I'll be on probably for another 5-10 more minutes. Like the stream, subscribe to the channel, hit that notifications bell. And of course, as I said before, I'm a couple $100 shy of my monthly goal before I stop asking. Patreon is quite complicated, but nonetheless, please do support my work. Help it become financially sustainable at patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. And that link and other ways to support me are in the description of this video. So stay put, like the stream. I'm just going to go through the chat a bit. Please do put your questions in the chat. I see that, there's a lot of chat here. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to all this. Oh, actually, all right, finally, I'm at the top. So I just want to thank the super chats first. Okay. There you are. Thanks for the super sticker, Adam. Appreciate it. Thank you for that. Thank you for the super chat, Chima. I think there was one more here. Okay. Here's here's a suggestion by Ileana McKee. Thank you for the super chat. It says, bring Pepe Escobar back. He really enjoyed talking to you. He said so in TV 247. Wow, really? That's awesome. I enjoyed talking to him, actually. He was very, I mean, he was chill. He was someone who, you know, I come off with a certain demeanor in this work. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm angry. So it's not like I watched the Jordan Sheridan Rome comment, RBN kind of thing, because JB Fauntleroy, I was watching his interview, parts of it, and Rome's response to, like, don't be angry, you're going to have a heart attack. I think that's what Jordan Sheridan said. And don't get me wrong, I'm angry. It's just in this setting, it's almost, for me, it's a strategic thing. It doesn't agree with everyone. Like, people want me to be screaming and all of that. That's never been me, really. I've always had kind of a strategic, I think, orientation to this work and this struggle, right? Trying to bring people the information that they need. And it's been like this whenever I do, you know, I've always had this kind of demeanor where I try to keep things kind of steady. Doesn't mean I'm not angry. It doesn't mean that I'm not furious. It doesn't mean that I'm not rageful over oppression, that I don't hate my oppressors. But it does mean that when I'm talking to you all, right, don't get me wrong, if I'm talking to the bourgeoisie, if I'm talking to ruling class sycophants, I'm going to be hostile. But if I'm talking to you all, I'm not. That's just not how it is. So anyway, thanks for the super chat. Pepe Escobar, totally. I will definitely have him back on at some point, especially as things continue to develop. So I think so here's another super chat. Donnie Nunn, thank you. Do you know about Zeitgeist Movement and can you interview Peter Joseph? I've heard of the Zeitgeist Movement. I don't know Peter Joseph. You can message me. I think if you have my email, I've heard of the Zeitgeist Movement. Actually, back in the day, before I was even political, I was working at a summer day camp, and the director, my boss, was like kind of into that. And yeah, thanks for the super chat. I would definitely check it out further, though. I'm not really quite remembering what it was all about. So anyway, Eliana said, great group of people here. Yeah, great. Right underneath the super chat. I just want to put that. It's true. My viewers, I love my viewers. You guys really do keep this, keep this fun. Anyway, so let's see. Let me see if I see any from the chat. Is there any other questions? Thanks for the stream. Okay, a lot of thank yous. So Anna Ringwald says, I've been drifting toward communism. How do I know when I get there? That's a good question. I can't answer that. All I know is that the more we drift toward communism, the more we fight for the first stage, socialism, here, and the more likely we'll have that as a world movement, right? The more likely that the world will be able to continue to chart its course. It's always been way ahead, right? The global south, the world socialist movement has always resided in the most poorest and oppressed countries, and that will continue. And the more we drift toward communism means the more we're fighting for socialism. So when we get, it's a different time in history. So although I believe that Karl Marx was correct, right? And he was definitely correct in certain the assertion of communism as a class of society. What that will look like when we do get there, because of the stage of history we're in and development, it'll just be something to behold. And I could talk about my thoughts, but I mean, you know, you know, it's all just kind of a pontification. So at the left lens, where does the theocratic character of the Repubs fit into all this? And the neo-Confederate character? Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the Republican Party, right? My theory about it, about the Republican Party, is like I kind of adopted this from Glenn Ford, because I always saw him as just so prophetic on this issue. I think the neo-Confederate, the kind of like ultra-racist, theocratic, like reactionary ideology that the Republicans, as like as an organ of the capitalist class, right, capitalist state. I think it's a real response to, one, the foundations of the United States being rooted in all of this. So it's always there, and it's always something. It's like a genealogy, right, that gets passed down and passed down. So it's always present. It's just when the Democratic Party moves further and further and further to the right, and politics move further to the right. You know, Glenn Ford used to describe it as like the Republicans being pushed toward a cliff that they can't really help but jump off of. And I think that's where a lot of the present politics of the Republican Party really come into play. Why, even decades after its reaction to the Black movement, right, which a lot of the Republican Party's politics are all about from the 1960s onward, a lot of that reaction now has gone kind of to this political cliff because the Democrats now kind of have occupied a lot of political space in other areas, especially in the economic realm, especially around militarism. So the Republicans are looking for an identity that they can really wrestle with and adopt in order to, one, maintain legitimacy in the districts and in the parts of the country where they need to maintain legitimacy and to have any semblance of political power, at least in on the surface level, right, at the level of representation. And two, you know, to really differentiate themselves from the Democrats in a way that keeps up the two-party con game. So that's a lot of this as well. And I think thirdly, it's just, this is what's going to happen when you have the overall forces of reaction strengthening, consolidating. You're going to have, right, even more intense forms of, you know, of the most reactionary elements of this social order. So that's a good question. So thanks so much for that question. So Brian Berletic also debunked it too. Yeah. I got to have him on. I was actually just in touch with Brian Berletic. I want to have him back on and collaborate more with him on foreign policy. Rome is the best. I actually really do like Rome. I like RBN. I like those folks a lot. They're genuine people. I think I'm going to be on Monday. I'm going to be on Savvy Sab's channel. I always enjoy talking to her. So I'll be there, I think, Monday night. Thoughts on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization comparable to South America Organizing by Lula? I mean, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is very important. It's part of these multilateral institutions that China is leading. I think it represents one of the bigger organizations with BRICS and now the Belt and Road Initiative, which I think is the biggest. But overall, I think the SCO is with the Asia Development Bank. I think in the new trade agreement, the RCEP. I mean, all of these things kind of cement China's influence as a force for integration and as a force for economic development, and as really the leader of that region, and also a world leader in many important ways, and something that we should come to terms with. But in terms of comparable to South America Organizing by Lula, I think, yeah, I mean, I know Lula is kind of at the head of this integration, right? I think he's already proposed like an independent currency. He's going to be running the next election. Super important that the Workers' Party get back leadership in Brazil. And I think it is comparable to a degree, but I think, of course, China has, I think, a bit more influence, a bit more capacity, sovereignty, just a stage of development. It's not in the so-called U.S.'s backyard or front yard or whatever the U.S. is calling it. Yeah, so I think that there are some differences just in terms of the magnitude of the impact of China's China-led multilateral institutions, but I think it's still comparable and very important. So say Rome Hu, he's on RBN. All right. And I know JB wants me on his show. I know I owe him so bad. So I feel bad. So I'll be definitely getting on his show. As I was about to, I got sick. And then since then, it just has not worked. But I'm going to be on his show. Don't you worry, everyone, because... Yeah, I Anyway, that's all. All right. That's all it seems like for the questions. Oh, love these streams, Danny says. Felix, thank you so much for the super chat. Really generous. I appreciate it. I always appreciate you coming on here. Thank you, Franny, saying thanks for another great show. So, to be honest, so RIP Shireen Abu Akleh, the Palestinian journalist recently killed by Israel. Danny Luna and EJ radicalized me, but Rome also helped me prior to RBN. Well, that's great to hear. So, thanks so much, guys. Thanks so much for coming on. I don't know. I don't see any other questions here, but I should get going. Thank you so much again, Felix, for your generosity. Many of us old farts are angry too, Danny, but we're running out of steam as we head into our 50s. Don't lose your fighting spirit, combat. Enjoy the small victories like the growth of this channel. Thanks so much. It's something that I need to hear sometimes, you know, because I've been frustrated. Actually, I'm in therapy. All right. I got to be in therapy. I've been in therapy since 2013. No, that's even when I was in college, I was like, damn, I got to be in therapy because I am. You know, for me, therapy is like one of these tools when the world, this situation, the conditions of life just become so toxic that it's like you gotta just have a space where you can just be. And so I've been in it for more than a decade now. And I'm very open about it. I think we should all be in therapy if we can. I've been in this situation where like you need it and you can't get it because your insurance won't cover it, because the person that you want, I'm a therapist now. So like I also see this from the other side, right? The therapist side. But I've been in a situation where you just can't get it because of healthcare in the United States. You just can't get therapy because you can't afford it, or the person that you want, the treatment that you want, is not covered. It's absolutely disgusting. But I've been doing it for 10 years now. I've needed to do it. And, you know, I've had to talk about this lately where I'm like, I need to really appreciate all of the progress that the work that I've been doing has made. And also, one of the things I've noticed is that the monetary side of this is toxic. I don't know. I see YouTubers, podcasters out here like always hearkening on this. I don't know how they do it because it is so toxic. I mean, everything about the monetization of things is just, it really does take you out of that, as Felix said, right? Appreciating the small victories, appreciating what you're doing right, appreciating how you're living by your values, how you're in this struggle, how you're doing this for the people, how you're staying true to your principles, because these principles are an outgrowth of something much bigger than you, of something that has literally won victories that have changed the lives of humanity in a way that is just earth-shaking and beautiful to witness, to be able to have witnessed, right? I mean, yeah, so I think that's totally true. We got to appreciate what we're doing here, no matter how difficult, because I've been dealing with challenges of burnout and, like, you know, dealing with the suppression and just, you know, I was recently just like, damn, every time I tweet something out, it doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. And then I had a friend explain to me the algorithm shit, and I'm just like, I can't organize my life around this damn algorithm. Like, this is rigged against, like, you have to do so much in order to like get boosted. And I see people out there doing that grind and having some success in it, but it feels like the tiny minority, and it feels like it has a cost, right? It has a cost on our focus and attention and what we talk about and how we talk about it. There's like this cost that isn't really acknowledged publicly, but I know it's there because I'm experiencing it, right? If I'm experiencing it, I'm not special. Like, I mean, I feel I'm special, but I'm, you know, like, I'm a person in the world, and other people in the world experience similar things. And I can't imagine that this isn't having a cost, but I see it in terms of content, in terms of focus, right? Even the Russia-Ukraine situation is like, there's a lot of just constant news reporting about that, which we need, but it's like there's such a demand and attention around it that I feel like a lot of other things get suppressed, so to speak. And that's just not who I am, you know, as an analyst. And so there is this conflict between who I am and what the demands are of these corporations, right? Because the corporations control our independent media sphere. And that's something that demands not just a lot of thought, but it demands a lot of therapy. So thanks for listening to that. Because I had to, quantification will kill your soul. You know, that's how it feels. Obey the algorithm. Exactly, everyone. You all get me. So I appreciate that. Anyway, you probably hear that music outside. Was it Saturday? Yeah, so it's Saturday. Franny said, I find it easy to live by my values. It's just hard to know for the people I know to deal with my values. That's true too. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. In any event, take care, everyone. This was a good chat. Thanks for coming. Great stream. Please do, as you're out of here, leaving this, please do like the video, subscribe to the channel, make sure you hit that notifications bell. And of course, as I've been saying, I'm working toward my financial goal on Patreon, patreon.com/DannyHaiFong. So please do, if you're able, subscribe there. And help keep this sustainable. That's about as far a promotion I go when it comes to the money thing. But the algorithm rules, as Carl's 4948 said, and that is exactly the thing that I just can't I can't stand it. But anyway, peace out, everyone. Take care. I'll be back again with a guest. I was gonna do it on Monday. It may get postponed, so apologies. I think I have to take my wife and I got to take our dog to the vet. He's having some eating changes, which are kind of strange to us. So, but it will happen. So I don't know when, but it will happen. Also, you know, make sure you sign up for the event. Go to Friends of Socialist China. Go to events. Sign up for the multipolar event, Imperialism's War and Multipolarity. Make sure you're doing that. Actually, I am going to put that in the chat now. So before you go, make sure you are registering for this event. I want to continue to plug it. Maybe a lot of you already have, but I want you to sign up for this webinar next Saturday. That's what I'll be doing next Saturday at 11 a.m. So here it is in the chat, and make sure. So there it is in the chat. Also, make sure to follow me on Colin, guys, Cold Boar Brew Podcast. Make sure you get that. I'd like to say I'm doing it tomorrow at my scheduled normal date, but depends on how things go. I think I am going to do it at some point tomorrow, but there is Cold Boar Brew as well. So be sure to subscribe to get that podcast, follow me there, and, you know, support that channel of mine. So anyway, peace out, everyone. That's all for the plugs. Take care. I will see you again next time. Bye-bye.